Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hi, and welcome to another episode of Sentimental Garbage, the podcast where we talk about the chick lit that made us who we are. My name is Karen O'Donoghue, and I'm an author, a journalist, and a blender full of semen. Joining me is author and perfect Lucy Atkinson's perfect mummy, Adele Parks!
Yay! The crowd went wild! I am the crowd, so
you are the
I'm
crowd.
Pretty excited.
The crowd of one. Welcome, Adele Parks. Let me know why you chose this book.
I chose Why Mummy Drinks by Jill Sims, because, and I'm sure you do know of this, or your listeners will know of this, but basically it's a diary of an exhausted mother. Mm-hmm. Now, my kid's grown up now, he's 18, so I'm sort of past that baby, young, constant exhaustion stage. But I remember it well because it scars you. So, you know, it stays with you. And I thought what was fantastic about Why Mummy Drinks when I first read it was it just gave us all permission to be slightly less than perfect.
Yeah.
She's way less than perfect. You know, she does drink. She does swear.
And she doesn't just like have a glass of wine on Thursday night.
No, she drinks.
She, mummy drinks.
Yeah, she like, does knock it back.
Like to the point where it's almost a bit dark in
You're
places.
A bit worried.
Yeah.
And actually, I think that's quite interesting as well, because yeah. You're right, it is a bit dark and light, and I think that's one of the things that's absolutely fantastic about the chick lit that we have is it's not all light and fluffy. There are a number of writers out there, and Jill is one of them, that wants to talk about women's lives in a very real way of going, yeah, look, we laugh, because if we didn't laugh we'd cry. Yeah, exactly. We're both laughing and nodding at each other. Yes, I know. So the story is about a mum with a young family and a pretty hopeless husband. I mean, he's not beating
he's called
her.
Simon as well, which is just like, Simon is one of those names in chick lit where it's a stand-in for so much. There's a whole bucket of qualities
that
go with the name Simon.
I need to tell you something personal now that I did not know.
First is your husband called Simon? I'm
first
sorry.
First one, start a marriage called Simon. But secondly, I have got in my latest book, Lies, 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 the character's called Simon.
Is he a sexy character or is he a Simon Simon?
No, he's a total pain in the arse.
Exactly, the pain in the ass name. Sorry to all Simons.
So isn't that interesting? I didn't know there was that subtext. It's clearly been in the back of my
head somewhere. I think I just have read so many of these books in such a short period of time over the last year that I have noticed what names are stand-ins for what kinds of traits. So Mark's, Chris's, Max's, sometimes Andy's, sexy boyfriend names.
Oh, totally.
Yeah. Simon's and Gavin's, and my boyfriend is called Gavin,
are
like that idiot who she went out with before the book was starting and he's broken up with her now and now she's trying to get over.
Okay.
That's what those names are.
Okay.
That's such a complete sideline. But
a total sideline, but kind of relevant as well, because the whole point of this book is her husband is useless. He doesn't beat her. He doesn't, he doesn't go off and do horrendous things. But he is just disinterested and he's not grown up.
Classic pain in the hole.
Totally. Hasn't grown up. He's not prepared to accept the fact he's now married with kids. I think he was kind of happy being married, but I think the kids thing has really sort of broken the idyll. Which, can I tell you, it can. I mean, no disrespect, and I love my family and I have loved being a mum all the way through, and it has been fantastic. But I think the joy of these books is it's allowing, as I say, for you not to be perfect, to have a drink, swear, have a few inappropriate mates. But there's the realism in these books. The school playground politics. Mm. Now, I don't know how many of your listeners out there are mums yet or are even thinking
of going
this way.
So I'm not a mum yet. So I.
Oh, would you like to hear about this?
I would love to.
Great contraception.
I did enjoy the It is great contraception.
Yes,
oh my God.
It is
I was
great
reading two books in the same week. One was like a high fantasy erotica and one was this. And I was like, just bring me back to the erotica.
Yeah.
I want to remember what it is to feel.
Well, also, you wouldn't be remembering much of the erotica once you'd had the kids, just saying. But anyway, I am digressing quite a lot. lot today. But yeah, it's great contraception because it makes out that being a mother is just one nightmare after another, which of course it's not.
Yeah.
There are huge times, like obviously the vast majority of it, you spend your time knowing you're fulfilled and this is great and you're carrying on, you know, humanity and you're trying to bring a decent human being into this world and you're trying to instill good stuff into your child. And all of that is really, really wonderful. And then there's the time where they're just spitting and clawing and biting you and you just feel like a failure.
It sounds great.
I'm selling it to you, aren't I? But as I say, mine is totally grown up now and it's all good and he has turned out to be a really lovely human being and I do think the planet is better because of him. But I remember these moments where you think, of all the places to have a meltdown, why did you have a meltdown in front of this mother?
Oh, God.
Which I think is what the book touches on as well, that it's hard enough being a mum and having... Your first duty of care is to that child and making sure the child is safe and healthy and hopefully happy, you know, so kind of fed and watered and the nappies are clean and all those good things. That's quite hard, okay?
Yeah, just we're breezing that is incredibly
over that.
Hard.
We're breezing over that, but that's pretty hard. But after that, there's all kind of these social... there's a social context that sort of now, and I think it is very now, women have to also kind of get their pre-pregnancy figures back super quick, like with it before they leave the hospital. And they need to always have their lipstick on and they need to, you know, be absolutely patient. They obviously, I know breastfeeding has got loads of medical advantages for your child. It's just not possible for everybody. But there's a lot of kind of, oh, you should breastfeed, and there's a lot of kind of, and you should be having sex with your husband again because you need to keep him interested, you need to keep your relationship alive. I don't know, though, look there, where that got you last time. Ripped vag, just saying. coming out rather than in, just saying. That would be really awful. I think you probably should edit that out. That's so awful.
No, I am absolutely keeping it in because the words ripped vag don't appear enough on this podcast, I don't think. What's really interesting about what you've been saying is, so we've been reading this from very different perspectives. I have children and you do. And while it is funny, there was too many points for me where because I think maybe when you're reading it as a mum, and this was written for mums and by a mum, to Jill Sims, the love of your child and the fulfillment and all that kind of stuff is so implicit to her and so implicit to her audience that she doesn't need to say it.
Yeah.
Whereas I'm reading it as a childless woman and I'm like,
you're a terrible mother.
Does this woman hate her children? Does she literally hate them?
No, but that's it. She doesn't. She will die for these children.
There's
she
some really
loves
lovely
these
scenes
children.
As well. Yeah.
And then that is the thing. And you're so brilliant to have pinpointed that because that is the thing. The love for your child, you know, is absolutely there, solid. It's a given.
So a given that you don't need to mention it.
You don't even need to say it. I mean, it is lovely if you tell them. They like it. Yeah. And and we are a family that tell each other we love each other
a
lot.
But in the context of, like, writing a diary to yourself, there is no... Because you know it too much.
You wouldn't say it.
It's not like when you're meeting up with a childless friend being like, and I do love them, because she's writing to herself.
Yes.
In the diary. She doesn't need to say that to herself.
No, because she knows. It is the makeup of her. That is her being. She loves these people. They are... her, but better, which is what you think of your children. You think they're me and maybe my other half if you still like him, but better. So that is implicit. So all the moaning and whinging and all the telling of the tantrums and the relationship failures that she's not quite dealing with and she's not quite admitting to is very human. And I was going on, I got sidetracked in my own head because I'm like that, I'm pretty random. But it's called creative, honestly. It is this thing about your child. So you've nurtured them, you've got them fed and watered, and then you've got yourself kind of functioning, and you're in clean clothes. You changed your knickers that morning. Life is going well.
Absolute star.
Absolutely, you need a gold star given to you, but you don't get that because you then meet the mom who grows her organic vegetables in her garden, pulps them, and feeds them to her child. And she will meet you the moment you're giving your child a cheesy what's it, which you only do once every 6 months when you're desperate. But anyway, that will be the moment you meet that particular mother. And I think that's what's quite interesting about the characters in the book, that she meets these sort of people at the school gate that terrorise her, really. And yet they're still only mums as well, and they have their own insecurities, yeah, and yeah. nobody's perfect, and they're also putting on a show, and they're also under huge pressure socially, or maybe in their own relationships or whatever. So I think there's such depth there.
And there's honesty. There's a kind of a reveal midway through the novel where she creates this sort of like app, and it's one of the more, because it's just a very grounded, very realistic novel about yeah. the very real struggles of parenthood and being a mum. And then it's like, it was quite a kind of a little bit far-fetched storyline about
wish fulfillment
of, she creates this app that is called Why Mummy Drinks,
yeah,
and it's basically like a Flappy Bird type of situation.
I am guessing, I don't know, I've literally no inside intel, but because this is kind of semi, it's not autobiographical, but kind yeah. of semi-autobiographical, and it is a diary.
It's a stand-in for being an author, isn't
it? I wondered. Yeah. I did think maybe, so this huge success came to her, her column worked, and you know what, and that took off, and maybe that's
yeah.
when she wanted to give it a sort of level of fiction and a level of sort of an anonymous slant. And so maybe that's why she's got this app. But what's yeah. interesting about it is she has this huge success. It kind of doesn't matter how she got this huge success. She mm-hmm. has it, but it's generally undermined, isn't it?
Yes.
Nobody takes it seriously.
So she makes like 200 grand out of yeah. this thing over the course of a year.
Yeah.
And everyone's like, oh,
your little hobby, thing. That yeah. little funny thing. And you know, what did you buy your mother-in-law for Christmas?
Yeah.
And, you know, and it's almost back-to-back question. And that's why, again, I think it might have been her novel writing, because, you know, you're also a writer. Mm. But I think a lot of people think writing is so easy and everyone could do it. And, you know, everyone's heard the phrase, everyone's got a book in them.
Yeah.
So if you are a writer, and I've been a writer now for 19 years, if I'd had a quid for everyone who told me that they were either going to write once they stopped their real career, or they had a great idea too, or
they'd love to have that the time for that. To,
yeah,
as if you just magic
as though you
some
just
time.
Kind of do yeah. it, and yeah. Then I would be a very rich woman, and life would be great. But so I think she's possibly trying to kind of work through some of her own issues, and I just yeah. thought it was really honest and really funny and
it's
frank,
very true.
And it gives women permission to be a bit murky, a bit less perfect,
yeah,
and I think that's not a bad thing.
And with the app as well, and it becomes this big hit or whatever, and it becomes a hit, and it's supposed to be lampooning the mothers who she hates.
Yes.
And then the mothers who she hates think it's about some other set of mothers.
Totally.
Do you know what I mean? Which
actually
is so
that was the only bit I was uncomfortable with.
Really,
I have to be honest, I spend my time trying not to hate other people.
She hates very liberally,
she
and that made me
does
uncomfortable.
I will say that about the novel. But that's only me. I'm a bit of a... my mum said to me, if you've nothing nice to say, don't say anything at all. I had a very silent childhood. but anyway...
But she is a bit... sometimes she's a bit too much of a bitch for me, and I'm a bit like,
I think that... I can understand what you're coming from with that. I totally can see that. And I felt uncomfortable with that. And I thought, I don't think I was ever that angry. And then I thought, maybe I wasn't. I just didn't dare admit it to myself. I don't know. But I don't think it's helpful, one group of mums hating another. But she kind of, I mean, plot spoiler, sorry. But she does work through that, doesn't she? She resolves that.
She does.
She does. And she sees people for what they are and she stops prejudging. And I think she's trying to teach us a lesson in that too.
Yeah. And there's this lovely scene where there's a woman across the street. So I actually skipped the plot summary entirely, but you kind of summarized it yourself in the first sentence. It's about a woman in a diary who has kids and it's hard. Like that, yeah. that is the plot summary. And a woman moves across the street about halfway through the book called Katie. And she seems kind of boring and anonymous, and her house is like from a catalogue, and she's a bit like, ugh, she's boring, and then she kind of forgets about her. Then her sister-in-law Louisa, who's like this mad hippie we'll get into more in a minute, moves in with her, and then Katie from across the road becomes obsessed with mad Louisa.
Uh-huh.
And then she kind of goes over, Ellen is incensed by this, be like, no, you should want to be my friend, don't
yes.
be my gross sister-in-law's friend. And that's when it all the kind of scales fall off, and she realizes that her sort of
judginess.
Your judginess, and her irresponsible sister is attracted to this woman because that woman feels so trapped.
Yeah.
And she's like, I haven't had taken a poo by myself in 3 years.
Yeah. And actually that showed that the character that Jill's writing about is quite selfish.
Yeah.
And I think that's an interesting thing. And I'm going to throw out something so controversial now.
Oh, sure.
Okay, so women have been having babies forever. Mm-hmm. That is why we are here. But now we sort of have permission almost to make hard work of it. And I wonder if we've gone a little bit too far. Because in this book, I know, I told you it was controversial. Ooh. God, I'm going to get so many complaints.
So many letters.
So many letters.
Our first letter, perhaps.
Because I know, yes, with a stamp. They're going to put stamps on that letter. No, but the thing is perhaps her life wouldn't be such hard work if she wasn't so busy judging other mums.
Yeah.
And she wasn't
then hating them for judging her.
Yeah, and classifying people and all that kind of thing, which I think is the lesson that the author is telling us and taking us through with the character and the character's growth. And the character definitely has those faults, which I think is fair to sort of show faults and then kind of iron them out. Mm. And she has her vulnerabilities and she has her strengths. And I think that's a real character. So that's good. But I think what happens is she is so obsessed with her own life and her belief that she's a failure, that she isn't quite bringing up these children the way she should, that she resents the woman that she looks at and thinks, oh, you are doing a good job. Instead of kind of going, God, you're doing a really good job. How are you doing it?
Well done, love. Yeah.
How are you doing it? Could you help me?
Mm. She asks for help.
No.
Ever.
And I think that would have been, it wouldn't make a great book because everything would be, it's not a good book if everything's great at the beginning and it's great in the middle and it's great at the end. That is not a good book. This is why this is a good book, because there is an arc and an uncomfortableness and then we get the resolve because she becomes good friends. They become good friends, don't they?
Yeah. And she does something. What I really liked about it, so the sister-in-law Louisa we talked about,
yes, nuts,
who arrives towards the beginning with her brood of six children, all named mental things, and they live in like way up in the highlands at this like wellness retreat, and it's like it's every new agey stereotype you can think of. And to the point where when I first was introduced to this family, I was like, oh, it's all just jokes about lentils kind of thing. And I was like, okay, well, this joke has kind of played out. But the longer we spend, because what happens is that relationship ends up breaking up. Louisa and her six children come to live with them for quite a while towards the end of the book. And we kind of peel back more layers of this character and basically how she has been allowed to not be accountable for anything her entire life.
Yes.
And Ellen eventually has to step up, give this woman, who she hates, $100,000 so she can start her new life and so her children won't be like taken into care, essentially. And
that's when we love Ellen, isn't it?
And that's what, and like it takes her like a week and a half to come to this because it's so, and she's like, I cannot believe I have to give this money.
I am bailing out the person I resent most. And the reason she resents her is because of, as you mentioned, she doesn't take responsibility. And having six children is a huge responsibility. Yeah. I should imagine. I haven't got six, I've got one. That's a big responsibility. So six is clearly a massive responsibility. And it's also a silly number. It's obviously to prove a point. It's for comedy. Mm. This book is, you know, we're talking about the serious bits. It's extremely laugh out loud funny.
Yeah, sorry. I feel like when I do this podcast, I always focus in on the issues and I'm never like,
but
this is funny.
It is extremely laugh out loud funny because, again, going back to if you don't laugh, you'll cry. But she has to do this. She is worried she's doing the thing that has always happened to the mad sister-in-law, that she's bailing her and she's giving her permission to mess up again.
Yeah.
But in fact, she's seeing the bigger picture that there are six vulnerable kids in this.
Yeah.
And actually, we start to get the characters of the children, don't we? And
we do
kind of
concertina
sneak through and you kind of go, that one really wants a decent, different
you really
life.
Feel for the kind of
you
the
do.
Oldest girl is a proper like she just wants to have normal clothes
and
there's a younger boy who's like a communist and he wants to reappropriate all of the devices
in
an act of like Marxist rebellion.
He just basically wants a device doesn't he, because he's not allowed on any screens and it's just his way of getting a screen that's kind of appropriate that his parents will allow. But but it's also actually about vulnerable kids and our responsibility as parents, and I think in a very comedic way all the characters grow up, even the sort of hapless husband. They all grow up and they all sort of take responsibility, and it's a kind of rite of passage, which actually having a child is a rite of passage. It's honestly the time when you realise you are an adult. Blow. I could have said something so much worse.
Blow.
Just because I know there's letters coming already, I don't want to make this worse.
You don't want three letters.
You don't want three letters, all with stamps.
One of the moments where I like literally laughed out loud, and I was also like, oh my God, I've never thought of this ever, because I have nieces and nephews and I love them very much, but I'm not ferrying them around the place. You know, I'm the fun aunt who comes in. There's a moment where she helps with the school trip towards the beginning of the book, and She's like, I hadn't realised how smelly children are because they're just farting all the time.
Yes.
And it's just this classroom of children farting constantly.
Yeah. And they have
my childhood classroom must have been full of farts.
Yeah. And they have another smell that's just, other mums will just go, you know, year seven smell, or will they go, year three smell? We know those distinct smells because it's to do with hormones, it's to do with sweat,
weird.
It's to do with what they've spilt on them, if they're still weeing. Well, obviously we all wee, but you know what I mean? Weeing, but not in the loo. So there's all sorts of smells all the way through.
Children have the worst breath. Why is that?
They're bad at cleaning their teeth.
They are bad. I love my niece so much and she has the worst fucking breath.
Yeah, they really need to help on the cleaning and the teeth. I think it is that. But I think teachers deserve a medal, don't they?
Oh,
my sister and my niece are teachers.
Just much more money.
Oh, a lot more money. That is what they need. So my sister and my niece are both teachers. And I have gone into my sister's classrooms before in the past. And that has always been my thing. I've come away thinking, how doesn't she notice
how bad they smell?
Yeah, because she's got a really good sense of smell like I have. Maybe she notices, but she's more polite than I am.
Oh, perhaps, yeah. Look, at a certain point, how much can you tell a seven-year-old that they stink?
Yeah, well, you can't. You never can. That's the thing. Lots of opening of windows. Lots of fresh air.
Yeah, a lot of fresh air, everyone.
I always stand in my coat with the windows open.
I by chance happened to see a talk with Caitlin Moran recently, and she used this term that made me think of it every time I was reading this book, which was, she says, you know, everyone loves to make TV shows and books about women in their 20s having weird sex and having depression and ennui and stuff. And she was like, when I found that my late 30s and early 40s have been where I've become the weaver of society. And that's what women's role is, where it's like you're like a human switchboard operator.
Yeah.
For like, oh, my mom's ill. Oh, my partner's mom is ill. Oh,
pulling
kids
everybody
need.
In.
Yeah. You become the switchboard operator between every different thread of society, mm-hmm. between the old and the young, between your in-laws, between that, and like that. That I just thought of that term the entire way through.
Absolutely. It is that sandwich thing that you're looking after a young family, but you might already be starting to look after older people as well. And maybe you've got siblings that aren't as settled, or, you know, and they still also need help. Or maybe they're more settled, and that's annoying too. Trust me. And so there's the, you know, and also you've got friendship groups, and your friends are quite often at very
different
series.
Their relationships are spinning up. And,
or they're just at very different times of their lives. So my kid's 18, and my best friend, one of my best friends, has got a 5-year-old and a 7-year-old. Mm. So our lives are so very, very different. And we've always had our kids at very different stages. And obviously when I had a kid for 11 years, she still was running around having a great time.
Yeah.
So there's all of that. And you just have to somehow hold it all together, because that is life. Whereas when you're at school and maybe a student, everybody is kind of progressing along at the same time as you, and you get tricked and lulled into false sense of security that, oh, everyone's going to just plod along at the same time as me. And when my good fortune happens, their good fortune is going to happen. If something goes wrong, it's probably going to go wrong for all of us. Oh, look, we've all got a bad teacher, which is the worst it can be at year 10 or something. But of course, as you get older, you're finding your own path, and none of our paths are the same.
Yeah, it's like it's splintering, and then those splinters splinter. Do you know what I mean? It's like maybe you have a baby at the same time as your best friend, but then her child has vastly different needs to yours, and that splinters her off. And it's just splintering, so you realise that it's just you on your own.
Yeah.
And maybe a partner, you know?
And also this thing about the sort of responsibility and understanding that actually it sounds very deep, but there's, you know, we're here. Make the most of it. We're always talking about that. Everyone goes, oh, live in the moment, live your best life. And I'm kind of spend a lot of time thinking, right, what is my best life? Part of your best life, actually, is being a decent, helpful, happy human being. And I don't mean helpful. That's become a kind of bad term, because it generally is associated with women, and that we're sort of seen as people pleasers. And I'm not suggesting for a minute that's what women should be. But I think everybody, no matter what your gender is, you should try and be a helpful, constructive human being, because we're part of a society.
Yeah.
And actually, this book touches on that. By having a little tiny microcosm society, it actually touches on, you do have responsibilities to people you might not like, you might not understand their values, you might not think that their life choices have been great, but you might still find you've got a responsibility to them. Which is huge.
Wow, it's such a great point as well, because I think the cult of the perfect mummy and that concept exists outside this book and everywhere in society. And I think even more so with, you know, it's such a boring point to bring up with social media, comparison culture, all of that, where it makes everyone feel like they're in these like tightly wound little units that has to like have a good shop front at all times. Mm-hmm. And then we lose the sense of like, we are society, yeah. You know what I mean? And
we are.
If another woman can't look after her child, then it is...
Help.
It is up to you to just step up and step in.
And actually, that's what mums do brilliantly. And I think in this book, the other thing that comes out is the warmth and kindness that actually does exist between school-get mums. So there's a lot of, I mean, I've already spoken about it, there's a lot of airtime, for want of a better word, given to rival mums and the perfect mum making the less perfect mum intimidated and who's judging who's more perfect than the other anyhow. But there's actually a huge community of people that... You can ring up, I know this throughout my career and my son's childhood, that there was always a bunch of mums I could ring up and go, I am late.
Yeah.
Can you pick him up? Can someone give him something to eat? And they would know his like timetable and they would know his food. And I did that for many other mums. And you just step in because you know.
And it has nothing, they might like you or they might not like you, but it has nothing to do with
Doesn't
you.
Matter.
But it's like, it's like it's a mother monkey has dropped her baby and I am now holding two babies.
Yes.
Like.
Because that child is part of the society and we want to teach them. You know, we're constantly saying to our kids, share, be nice, don't hit, use your words, all those things. And then we forget that as adults, all of those things are appropriate and reasonable. And the only reason we're telling our children is because that's what we would like them to be as adults. So I think all of that kind of comes through. And it's only this kind of wise old sage, because he is 18 now, that I can look back and think of these things. Because when you're in the actual storm, you don't get time to breathe. You just think, thank you, or bugger you.
When you were in the eye of the storm, if you had time to read, would you have appreciated this, or would you have wanted an escapism? Would you like, because recently I recommended that my sister saw, who's in the eye of the storm, she's got a 7-year-old and a 4-year-old, I recommended that she saw the movie Tully, which I don't know if you've seen it, but
I haven't, but I know of it.
But kind of a similar vibe to this, with a kind of a Fight Club edge.
awesome.
And she went to see it, and she was like, "I just didn't want to. No. I didn't want to see a mirror. I wanted to see a portal." You know.
Yes, I think it's okay if there's a solution.
Yeah.
I think that's what we all need from our novels, anyhow. Totally different. The kind of stuff I write is set in homes and in families, but it's pretty dark. You know, it's domestic noir. Something is going to go badly wrong and horrible. So most people reading that don't want to be that. They're almost glad it's worse for someone else and they're kind of nosy about it. But they're also looking for a resolve. Mm. And I think that's the point of this book. There needs, and there is, a resolve of sorts. You know that she's muddling through. You know her kids are going to be fine. You know that her nieces and nephews are going to be better because of her intervention, which has come from her work and her earning this money. Mm. And so you know she is growing and developing as a human being, and that's kind of lovely. So when Conrad was tiny, what did I read? God, did I even... I mean, I remember this very clearly. So I've written a book a year throughout his life.
That's incredible.
Thank you. Thank you.
Incredible.
I remember going to an... So I was in this NCT group. There was 7 of us and we were close. But the thing we genuinely had in common was our babies were born within a month of each other. Mm. So somehow we were signed up into a club that I don't even understand. Right? I don't even know when
What's
I signed
NCT
up to
club?
It. National Childbirth Trust, which is a really nice charity that basically... And now I'm woolly on the details. But when you have a brand new baby, you can kind of go into your local community and say, my baby was born on this date. Anybody want to meet up for a coffee? And the National Childbirth Trust.
That sounds nice.
It
sorry,
is.
People must be like, Caroline, you're an idiot. I'm sorry, I just don't know this world.
No, but I was exactly the same. And this, I was told by another mum to do this and I did it. And so there's sort of 7 of us and we were put together as this group. And first of all, the National Childbirth Trust woman, who probably has like a 3-year-old, hosts it in her house, sees that we kind of get on and none of us are axe murderers. And then we sort of swapped it between our houses. And we had joint baby birthday parties and we were friends for a few years. And it was a really lovely friendship for like a period of time when we all just needed to get ourselves moving. But I do remember writing a novel a year throughout that and trying to get the mums to support me by buying my book. I know, very, very commercial of me. But I was going, my book's coming out next week. Please will you buy it? and tell your friends to buy it.
You gotta hustle, man. Especially gotta if you hustle. Can't be going down to London every 10 seconds.
I was a single mum at this point.
Oh,
so I
Jesus.
Definitely had to hustle.
Adele,
yeah.
What are you like?
And so, and I remember loads of them just turned to me and went, oh, I haven't got time to read. So, and I was like, I've written it.
Don't you give a have, fuck.
Yes,
buy it.
Just buy it. Use it as a coffee mat. Do what you need. But it was quite interesting. So it's quite interesting thinking, what did I read at the time? I think I did carry on reading. This just wasn't out. I mean, another reason I'm attracted to this book is it's kind of a Bridget Jones for grown-ups. So I was the Bridget Jones generation.
Yeah.
But I remember when I read Bridget Jones thinking, well, I don't really behave like that, but I know someone who does. So I guess. Which I was, by the way, kidding myself, just saying. Mm. So I guess if I'd read this when I had a young one, I'd have thought, oh, well, this isn't me, but I kind of know who it is. Because I don't think we see each other ourselves very well, maybe.
I was thinking as well, it's really interesting, maybe it's in all traditions of literature, but particularly in British literature, there is this thing of, like, I think maybe because the society has always been so obsessed with maintaining a good shopfront, even pre-Instagram, pre-whatever, of the secret diary thing. So we had Diary of a Nobody, which was, you know, very, very a mirror to this, and like very middle class people trying to do their middle class thing, but like dying on the inside.
Exactly.
Like Adrian Mole, like that whole series, Bridget Jones or whatever, this thing of people who are trying so desperately to present a perfect shopfront and failing, and their internal sort of thoughts. I think that formula works with English people in a way it just chimes.
We must be very nosy, maybe.
Yeah.
Because there's nothing more exciting. Yeah. Because there's nothing more exciting than reading someone's diary. Not that I ever would. I so would. It's a good job I don't have a teenage daughter.
I know. I was just thinking, teenage boys never keep diaries.
No,
surely.
They don't keep diaries. And, you know, no, because they'd have to write.
There has to be like one ever, and it was David Bowie. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah. But the kind of idea of reading someone else's diary is very secretive. And I think it is a lovely literary device because it's basically saying, look, I'm allowing myself to be myself. Mm. And I'm just letting it all out. But it is, as you quite rightly point out, also saying, because there is nowhere else for this to go. And whether that's because you're an angst teenage boy, a.k.a. Adrian Mole, or because you're a fretful mum, there is nowhere else to go and I'm feeling vulnerable and lonely and the only person I've got is myself. But, you know, there's nothing wrong with a bit of self-reliance, which is the other thing about a diary. It is basically working through understanding yourself, having support, having friendship groups, having family and people that kind of tip up and turn up and chip in. But in the end, you're working out, who am I, what am I about, what have I got inside me?
Yeah, and another great device, another thing that the device allows, rather, is that it allows our characters to write down what they want to do, and then we get to see how it goes.
Yes, exactly.
Which is a big thing in this book, isn't it?
It's also quite an interesting device, because it's quite restrictive, because you have to be, I think that's why she has to
show. You can't
have
anything in the present tense, can you?
No, and you can't have anybody else's opinions or thoughts, because they've always been filtered through the diary. So, you know, there's only going to be Ellen's opinions and thoughts on what someone else might be thinking.
Yes.
You can't genuinely see what her sister-in-law is thinking. And in that way, Ellen's kind of a bit foolish, because actually we all are, because we're actually myopic. And we do only see things from our own points of view, and we have to grow and we have to kind of do this community thing and understand that there's other points of view. And I think that's what Jill, the writer, the novelist, has done. She has given Ellen the kind of role of we're laughing at her. Mm. We're laughing with her sometimes, but we're also laughing at her because we see her faults quicker than she does. And so she's sending herself up too, which is quite interesting.
And so you've read the whole series at this point, because this is a three. The first one came out in 2017, and the third one is already out.
Yes, I haven't read the third one, so I've done the first two, and actually I did them in a bizarre order. I came across the second one first, and I read it, and it's the kind of novel you can pick up the second one and kind of go, yeah, I get it, because she was on about her huge kind of app success.
Yeah.
And then when I went back and read the first one, I was like, oh, that's sweet. You know, I would recommend you do read them in the proper order and not have the kind of scatty approach I have. And I might be done now. I might not even, you know, read the third one, but I probably will if I have like a little hour and I need a bit of a cheer up.
You're going to be in W.H. Smith soon near an airport.
I will.
Like you're
and it is a cheer up, you know, it gives you a giggle. You will laugh out loud.
And you just breeze through as well, you know what I mean?
You do breeze through.
It's a great sort of like Kindle, like, la, 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 you just float through it.
But you see, why I said I might be done is I'm going, like, okay, he is 18. It's time to not
let
just,
go of this.
Yeah, yeah, let go of the kind of how I define myself is because I'm a mother. And now let's how I define myself is something different. I'll come back to them when I'm a grandmother. I hope she does. Oh, my God, well, wouldn't it be brilliant? Great. She should keep writing.
So what happens in the follow-on books? And like, I would be really interested to know because the first book is a debut for Jill.
Yes.
And it was off the back of this huge blog called Peter and Jane. And it was sort of a kind of a send-up of those puffin readers. Like, Peter and Jane go to the beach and...
Yeah, and behave perfectly.
Yeah, exactly. And so it was, so she had to like take this very short form but very popular thing and make it into a novel. And you can see it as somebody who is now on their third project, and so my debut is still very fresh in my mind, of like... Oh, I can see when another debut person is working things out, figuring out what they want to say. And how does her story structure evolve, do you think?
Her characters, so the kids obviously age and grow up, so the challenges are slightly different, and I think that's part of it. All her other accessory characters all develop in slightly different ways. Mm. And actually, it's a bit like watching a soap opera. So,
yeah,
you know, like when
you
buy into Coronation Street or EastEnders or whatever, and you just kind of grow up with people, I think that's what's going to happen for Jill. There'll be a lot of people with kids younger than mine who did start reading this at the same time, you know, with kids about the same age as the ones in the book, and they will probably grow up with her, and she probably will take them through teenage years and all the tantrums and slamming doors and drink and drugs and...
Yeah.
Threats.
Because in the first one, they're quite small still. And she never says specifically how old
they
are.
Which is quite clever.
Very clever.
Yeah, keeps it open.
But you get a sort of like a...
Also, in your diary, you don't say how old your children are.
No, of course you wouldn't.
So you see, she's really good. She's really honest and really real. She hasn't broken the third wall.
Yeah.
You know, she has done all that kind of keeping it.
Why would you? She never tells herself anything that...
You would know.
You wouldn't. Yeah, exactly.
Because you never sit and write my diary and go, my children are now 4.
Yeah, and I live in the town of Black. Yeah. Like, she lives fairly far from London, that she has to take a long train.
Yeah.
But that's all you know.
Exactly. And that, you know, you know her views on that train journey, actually, is the thing, you know, and that's how you learn stuff about her. So I think that's quite cozy as well, because I think that works, and I believe in it more because of that. If she set it up saying at the beginning, if there's just a little cheat paragraph of saying who was who, be a bit disappointed. I've liked discovering the people. The way if you do meet a neighbour in the street, you might slowly discover them and find out more about them.
And it's nice through the year of the first book, you kind of, at first her kids seem very like amorphous blobs, just like things that are in the way, and then you slowly get an idea of their personalities. Like Jane's quite sort of serious and tomboyish
but
also quite destructive but proper.
Yeah.
And then the boy is like quite a little Lothario, and he's quite cute and he's quite cuddly and stuff, and you kind of do get to like them. How do they develop as it goes on? So I'm really interested to know.
Yeah, so they do get older and they go into school and that kind of thing. But we do just get another year in the next diary.
Yeah.
So she hasn't kind of given us, she hasn't suddenly grown them to, you know, whatever level. So there's a lot more kind of... it's wrong to say there's more of the same because that's doing a disservice. But the characters we love are there again. But you see them, I can try not to give too much away, you see them move and develop, and you see friendships grow and things fall apart.
Your typical sequel.
Yeah, yeah, I'm trying not to give too much away. But maybe her marriage comes, let's just put this way.
Ooh,
her marriage.
Simon, boring Simon.
Simon gets a bit more of a microscope, I think.
Oh.
Yeah, I think the focus shifts a bit more in the second one.
That's interesting. Mm. He's a bit of a mystery.
He is, and he's just almost... And
he's
actually
a bit of a cliche. Just
he just disappears. And actually, a lot of husbands... Well, some of them completely disappear. But some of them still live in your house and disappear when kids come along. And men quite often say, well, I didn't find a place and I felt pushed out. And others kind of go, you know, you want to say to them, make a place. Push yourself back in. I really need you. And I think that's another thing she's sort of talking about. And that comes up in the second book.
Oh, I'm interested.
But I'm interested in the third one, because the third one is called Why Mommy Doesn't Give a... And then there's an S and some stars. So you have to make that word up.
Just a little word puzzle
little
for you
word
there.
Little word puzzle, work it all out. Anyway, but that's quite interesting if you literally don't give a... Isn't it? Because that's a flip again. I wonder if it's all going to just fall apart. Don't know.
Oh,
I am going to need to read it on the way home.
Stop serving lunch altogether.
Yeah, I'm going to pick it up on W.H. Smith Travel on the way home.
Great.
Yay.
When you write mothers in your books, so have you, I know you write domestic noir and you've written a hell of a lot of books, but is there, do you have anything front of mind when you're, because you are a mother and you know that they're within your demographic being like, is there a way of that you wanted to represent motherhood responsibly? Like, you don't want to fall prey to the same old stereotypes?
Yeah, I think, interestingly, with domestic noir, I tend to take my characters to very, very dark places. So I've had novels about a mother with a 15-year-old being told that actually, biologically, this one baby you've brought up for 15 years isn't yours. The babies were swapped in a hospital.
Right.
And, you know, this baby isn't yours. And that was all about motherhood. Mm. That's called The Stranger in My Home. And that was all about, you know, what is motherhood then?
Yeah.
Is it the 15 years you've been nurturing that child, or is it the biology? And the only reason it's come up is because her child now might have a genetic problem because her birth mother had a genetic problem, and that's why they've bothered to track her down. So so I've written books like that. I've also written books about mothers dealing with having a young male in their house and realizing they're men. They're not, they're just their boys. Because I think that's a really interesting thing as a mother of an 18-year-old. And I almost found it to the day that he stopped being my baby boy, and which is stupid because obviously at 17, he's nobody's baby boy. And he's way taller than me and has been since he was 13. But by the time he was 18, almost to the day, I just thought, oh my God, you are a legal man.
So scary.
Yeah, because actually then it's
like you can be imprisoned, you can be knifed.
You can be knifed. You can go and do whatever you want. I can't stop you. You could drop out of school. You could take drugs.
And also, societally, you become, in some sense, a dangerous thing.
Yes.
You know?
All of those things. And then it's still your baby boy. So actually, I was really, I invited her in. That was looking very closely at that mother-son relationship and, you know, when do you let go and how do you let go, but still support them. Because actually, whilst we talk a lot about supporting mums when children are little, there's not a lot said about being a mother of a teenager.
Mm.
And actually being a mother of a teenager can be very scary and stressful, and you're worried for them a lot of the time. There are a lot of really big threats out there. And so it definitely changes, and I wanted to look at that. And then Lies, 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 which is my latest novel, is actually about a woman who she's you know, in her 40s, but she has a very, very young child. And the plot is, I'm going inside track, but I'll tell you anyway. The plot is that she's been with her partner for 20 years. They've got a 5-year-old. She thinks they're done. They're the perfect little threesome. That's her family. He's actually kind of coming under pressure from society and life, I guess, that he thinks the one other thing he needs to give this child is another sibling. And even though there have been years of IVF to get this first one, and she's like, I'm not prepared to do anymore, we're done. And he's like, no, I think just one more push, let's just have another sibling. So first of all, quite an interesting dilemma between the family.
You rarely see that represented of the male partner wanting
the child. Yeah. But also, this isn't a spoiler because it's first chapter, but then he goes to, he thinks, I'll just get the ball rolling. You know, in that way when you tell a man something and he doesn't want to hear it, so he just carries on anyway.
Sure.
So, yeah, good.
I live with men, yeah.
I've met a man in the street. So he goes to an IVF expert and says, you know, I just want to hear, is there any improvements and what we'll have to go through again, and can I just have myself all checked out again? And the guy does that and he says, okay, the bad news is you're never going to be able to have another baby. You know, you're done. But the other bad news is, you never, ever have had a baby. Oh, brilliant. That is such
a
great
response.
Ooh, hello.
Oh, my God.
So then...
That's so good.
So then what's the mother's responsibility?
Oh, you're very good at this now.
Oh, bless you. Thank you. So what's the mother's responsibility there? What has she done? Why has she lied to her husband? Why has she let him bring this child up for 5 years when he is not the father?
Wow. And so is it told from his perspective, first person?
Half and half.
Oh.
Her perspective and his perspective, first person. I haven't mentioned this bit, which is also why I liked Why Mommy Drinks, because I am interested in our relationship with alcohol. Must come back to that. We haven't talked about that.
Yeah, yeah.
But Simon, in my book, is a functioning alcoholic who clearly, after this news, functions ever so slightly less. Just saying. And it absolutely goes tits up because he he does go off the rails, and whilst actually his the starting point of this novel is him just wanting his family to be the perfect family, he blows it apart in ways you can't imagine.
That's so interesting. I've never heard anything like that from the perspective of a dad. Yeah. Like, I'm actually really excited to read that. I'm not even taking
the piss.
Thank you. Because you do just say that to people, don't you? Like, oh, can't wait. And you're like,
oh, that's
bye.
So brilliant. Yeah, bye. I didn't take down the name. Can't remember who I was into.
Who are you, bye? Yeah.
But yes, lies, a dull part. Yes. But no, that is, but going back to drink.
Let's talk about it.
Because that is what another reason I liked why Mummy drinks, and it's a big deal in my book. I think we've all got a really interesting relationship with alcohol, and it's not out in the open yet. And I think Why Mummy Drinks was bringing it out in the open a little bit
more. I think women's drinking is something that is never spoken about.
Yes. Yeah. Except sometimes in the Daily Mail to scold us.
Oh, sure. But it's always like, look at these 18-year-olds out on New Year's Eve drinking themselves into comas. Do you know what I mean?
Binge.
Never like, here's this 37-year-old mother.
Yes. Who... And why is she drinking? And why is that her wind down? Why is that her crutch? Why is that her social lubricant?
Yeah.
And why are we all... And it is all those things.
And I think...
That's just me.
And yeah. Well, no, I have to reference my sister because she is my closest ally for this, in that she is not this character.
Because this is an extreme. It's a parody. It's fun.
But she fucking loves her gin in the evening, loves her bottle of wine with dinner or whatever. And I can see the switch in her because it's like a gong has been hit of like, the children are asleep. This is my time now. That's like when the ice goes in the glass. And I must say, my sister Jill is a wonderful parent and non-alcoholic, and Jill, please do not send me letters. But I can see the relief being like, oh, like now begins my time. Do you know what I mean? Because it can't be. I think it used to maybe a generation ago to be like, oh, when the TV goes on in the evening. But now TV has become almost more stressful because it's like screens on all the time, sounds all the time, lights all the time.
That's interesting.
You know?
Yeah. And also that thing about my time. If you imagine a life, right, where you don't go to the loo on your own.
That's in this book a couple of times,
so
and
true.
Every time it gives me
because
such pause.
It's
I'm like,
the biggest
wow.
shock when you're
to not take a poo by
so,
yourself.
Yeah. So
for
you come
years.
Home from hospital and you're so bothered about your baby, you don't like it in a separate room to you. So then the first time you need to go to the loo, you kind of go, "You are kidding me! What am I going to do? Well, I can't leave it here. What if it wakes up? You know." So you take the baby in the loo when
and you're like swaddling it to your chest. As
no, it's usually like a little. Quite often, like a little. Could I suppose you could, but you don't. You normally put them in like a little. Cot thing, you know, like the seats.
Yeah, like the bassinet.
And they go in like a little seat on the floral thing, and they're there. But the same when you shower, all those things. So my baby was born on the 1st of November, and I remember going, wait for it.
Same birthday as my boyfriend.
Yay! Great birth time. Scorpio is very passionate. So 1st of November, I remember going Christmas shopping at, wait for it, Sainsbury's on my own.
Wow.
And thinking it was a treat. So he was about 7 weeks old, and my then husband had said he would look after him.
Hello. Babysit his children?
Babysit his children for 2 hours while I went shopping. And it was so late by the time this happened because it was various, like, I don't know, pooing in baths and things like that, that by the time I finally did get out of the house to do this, the only place that was still open was Sainsbury's. And I remember wandering around the Sainsbury's aisles thinking, I love this place. I love Sainsbury's. Sainsbury's is Tiffany for girls that have got babies.
Nothing truly awful could happen to you at Sainsbury's.
Yes, exactly. All of that. So I think that thing of how can you make me time in your own house does become drink for quite a lot of people. So, and that's not, you know, that's not just a female thing, that's also a male thing. And I just wanted to look at that too in my book. And also that's why I thought Why Mummy Drinks was...
What's interesting as well, because I think online gambling and app gambling becomes a thing as well.
Yes.
Which I thought could have been a nice avenue, but maybe would have taken it in too far a different direction if her app had been sort of a pay for.
Now you've said that, I bet like book four is going to be Why Mummy Gambles.
I would love Why Mummy
Wouldn't
Gambles.
Wouldn't that be good? Yeah.
Adele Parks, we have to wrap up.
Which is a shame because I'm loving my afternoon.
This is great. You've already plugged to High Heaven, your new book, which sounds amazing. And honestly, I do just say that all the time. I think we should part with who do you think would play the characters in a movie or a TV show?
Of my book or of...
In this book,
ooh. I'm useless at this. I'm really useless at this.
Well, actually,
let's pick someone like... Would you pick someone like Anna Froggatt for the mum. So she was, sorry, Joanna Froggatt for the mum, because she was Anna in Downton Abbey. You know, like...
Yes!
She was the maid, the posh lady's maid.
I remember.
She'd be quite good, because she can do that dark, despairy stuff.
Yeah, and lots of, like, humor. Staring out the window, but also...
And the humour. Yeah. I don't know.
I think it's actually quite close to Sharon Horgan's motherland, isn't it?
Yes.
So yeah. I think maybe just... Plop all the cast
in
there.
I didn't know you were going to ask me that. I should have.
No, it's fine. Sometimes I bring on people. Sometimes
I can't do that, because I think it's really hard. It's also like, if you've read a book and you, after you've seen the film, it's so hard, because then you just have the people who played in the film in your head when you read the book. So when I always try to read books first, and actually I never go there. They are just personal to me. I kind of make them up. So no, sorry. Useless.
I think
really
it's very interesting how people have different relationships with this, because for me, I like, before I even start a book, I just find the actors first, create a Pinterest board, print the Pinterest board, and then stare at it for 3 months.
That's fantastic.
I mean, I think it's quite shallow, to be honest. I'm like...
Yeah, I don't mind puddle.
Anyway, we better go.
Fantastic.
But, Adele, thank you so much for coming in. This has been wonderful.
Thank you.
This has been Sentimental Garbage, and I've been Caroline O'Donoghue. You can follow me on Twitter at Zaroline, that's Czaroline, or email me about the podcast at ZaroLineO'Donoghue@gmail.com. This has been a Justice for Dumb Women podcast. Thanks to Harry Harris for the jingle, Gavin Day for the logo, and Acast for the recording space.
Want your most burning finance and investing questions answered? Here's a podcast you should be listening to, courtesy of Acast Recommends.
Are you ready for some personality in your personal finances? Hi, I'm Janice Torres Rodriguez, Latina money expert and host of the award-winning podcast, Yo Quiero Dinero. On this show, we're serving up POC-friendly personal finance knowledge, always with a side of sass. We're not talking about avocado toast and lattes on this show. We've got real, relatable personal finance knowledge that makes you feel seen, heard, and finally understood. Consider me your super cool, slightly risque, but always honest financial fairy godmother. Together, we'll tackle dinero in a fresh new way, so you can finally become poderosa with your dinero. Check out our weekly podcast episodes at YoQuieroDineroPodcast.com or subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.